Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show. Jill is off with the WRTI Travel Club touring beautiful Santa Fe, New Mexico. She'll return next week. Jill's absence this week gives us a chance to encore her 1998 interview with the late jazz pianist, composer, and arranger Brian Traynor. Brian passed away at the beginning of July this year, a great loss to the jazz community. Brian grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, listening to both classical music and jazz. His dad, a singer who worked as a meat cutter during the day, made sure his training started very early, beginning piano lessons way back in kindergarten. As Brian grew up, he had the good fortune to have saxophonist Richie Cole as a neighbor. It was Cole who introduced him to Phil Woods, with whom Brian would study theory for a while. Brian was also very lucky to have one of his idols, pianist Bill Evans, work with him. He counted among his influences Bill Evans, Thelonious Monk, and Bud Powell. Brian's career really started in earnest in the late 60s, and over the years, he's led his own group as well as having played with some of the greatest musicians in jazz, like Steve Marcus, Richie Cole, Cecil Bridgewater, Dennis de Blasio, and many others. Brian was well known to us here at WRTI, a good friend of the station. He'd phone or he'd drop in every now and then with a new CD or just to say hello. Brian's music also had, and still has, a great presence on our jazz playlist. I was lucky enough one Friday night to be filling in for Jeff Duperron while Jeff pulled hosting duties at the Cape May Jazz Festival a while back. Brian called in from his car as he was heading down to Cape May himself, I would assume along that Cape May freeway. Well, he called just to say hello and to tell me how good it was to hear me on the air during the jazz programming. It was just the shot in the arm I needed to finish my time on the air that night after working a regular day that day. Not long before his death, Jill had talked to Brian about being a guest on Crossover again to talk about his newest CD and to play in our new performance studio for the show. He was his usual upbeat self, talking about the CD and the fact that he was to be music director in an upcoming jazz festival. He just had to check his schedule, then he'd get back to Jill to set up a taping date. It was maybe just a couple of weeks or so later that Jill and I were editing another show when Maureen Malloy broke the news of Brian's passing. Needless to say, the rest of our edit session that evening was colored with sadness. His newest CD was at last check scheduled for release on Summit Records in mid-September. Brian Traynor would have only been 57 at the end of this month.
Welcome to Crossover. I'm Jill Pasternak, and we have a very special guest with us today, Brian Traynor. Welcome, Brian. So good to have you with us.
Good morning.
Well, what was all that about?
It's Bernstein's Girl. The actual title of that song is Bernstein's Girl on a Passing Ferry with Porcelain Hands and a Parasol. Yes, it's a long title. There's a moment in the film Citizen Kane, you know, the journalist is trying to find out what Rosebud is. And he goes to one of his oldest friends, Mr. Bernstein, and he asks him, could Rosebud... that Bernstein suggests, could Rosebud be a girl? And the young journalist says, no, I can't envision that. So Mr. Bernstein responds, well, young man, you're too young to know this, but there was a time when I was young and I was going across to Jersey on a ferry, and a girl was in another ferry coming the opposite way. And I saw her for only a fraction of a second, and she didn't see me at all. But I'll bet not a day goes by that I don't think of her. And that's basically what that song is about. It's about those moments that really do inform our lives. I don't think that the sum of a human being's life is necessarily told in the big things that they do. I think it's those small moments which really matter. The porcelain hands and a parasol. Well, of course, there was a parasol mentioned in that film clip. But the porcelain hands, when I was a kid, my mom used to have these wonderful porcelain figurines. And I always loved the porcelain hands of them. So when I put flesh on this person, that's who it was.
How did you become inspired? I mean, Citizen Kane as an opus, there's so much to absorb in that. How did you pick up on this particular scene or this fleeting moment?
I don't know. Just watching the film, it struck me that they're searching for a big event throughout. And remember, Rosebud was nothing but the sled as a child. That's really the theme at Citizen Kane. It's not the big events. So I think that particular scene was very moving to me, thinking how this man would think of this one little person, this one woman, who he never met. There was no other part to that story but that. That's what struck me as interesting.
The impact of strangers on our lives.
Huh? I suppose, yeah. I suppose.
Well, you've also, the way you've structured it is very precious. I mean,
it's a sentimental, it's through written. There is absolutely no improvisation done.
That's a wonderful terminology, through written, I guess, or through composed.
Yeah.
It's a jazz
mm-hmm.
terminology, which means that it's written mm-hmm. out.
Yeah, it really is. And it's played that way every time. So, that's just one of those elements. There's a few tunes I have or compositions I have that are like that.
How do you feel about writing something that is set down and can be repeatedly played the way you have indicated, which is what classical composers do?
Yeah, I think it's great, but you have to give enough freedom for interpretation, though. Yeah, Bill.
But I mean, do you ever want it to be played without improvisation?
Geez, I never. Once I'm done with the composition and I've performed it and I have it set in my mind, it's a child. You know, it's out there in the world. It can be interpreted and do as it wishes. If someone wants to improvise upon it, please go ahead. You know, I don't think I have an objection to that. I don't know.
No, it's a very interesting point coming from, you know, the jazz world. And this is kind of written in stone, because classical music is written in stone.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. And it never used to be, but it is.
Don't tell that to Glenn Gould. I mean, so there is a history of improvisation in classical music.
Well, I think the old masters, obviously.
Sure.
But but in essence, that has been the distinction when we talk about jazz and classical. And I think it's interesting to find you, mm-hmm. A jazz performer and composer, mm-hmm. playing something that you wrote down straight through.
There are, in my last four CDs, I think at least on every one composition that is that way.
Where were you trained?
Well, actually, I started, at the age of four playing piano, and I started my lessons as an experiment at Trenton State College with some people. They wanted to see what I could do. And then, I took some various lessons through a church, straight classical music training. And then, of course, since then, I've traveled and gone to courses all over the world, you know. And
how does it stand you in jazz? I mean, is it technically helpful?
Oh, you know, very much. Very much.
Piano-wise.
Well, piano-wise, technically it does, of course. You know, you have to do your homework to get your fingers to do what you want them to do. But I think it expanded my understanding of music more. Mm-hmm. Remember in jazz, we've had a history of writing riffs or writing off pop forms. Well, in classical music, they're not writing in that restrictive form. And I think that's very much what has influenced me. The fact to expand the form.
So. You know, you and I were talking at one mm-hmm. point, and you said something about there are only three chords.
Yes, there is.
One,
only
two,
three.
And five.
Well, two, five, and one. I'll put them in that proverb.
So, in other words, there's an order. You're talking about an order.
Well, all you know, musical chords, all musical sounds can be broke down into one of those three general categories, and no matter what it is.
So one being a root?
Well, no. One being a major seven chord. A major chord with a major seventh. The two chord is a minor chord, and the five chord is a dominant. So let's just say that it's those three phrases. The chord can be a major chord, it can be a minor chord, it can be a dominant of some type. That covers everything. There's no possibility of another.
So that's for modulation purposes, I guess.
Well, for modulation, for organization, for understanding, for analyzation. You better know that there are basically only three chords.
Brian, you had a marvelous ensemble there.
Yeah, this particular trio has been together, and still is, for 9 years with Vince Fay and Bill Jones, both very accomplished musicians. They work across from, well, any field. Vince is currently doing Footloose on Broadway, in the pit band there. He completed Grease. He's on a constant call for commercials. He teaches at Temple University. Bill Jones is a teacher. He's played every show imaginable in Atlantic City and just anywhere. And they're both highly trained. And Bill also teaches here and a few other places. They just seem to know where I'm going to go with the music before I go there.
What is that? Intuition?
I suppose. Our rehearsals, we'll laughingly call them rehearsals. I'll come in and talk a bit about the music, what I intend to say. What's my intent? And I'll maybe give him my chicken scratch, the notes. And then it's open for interpretation by them. And they just listen so closely. Yeah, they surprise me.
And they probably do things that you didn't expect as
right.
well.
Right. Well, they'll make... Sometimes I look at my music and I say, Jesus, although I composed it, they're co-composers in some ways. They'll bring new ideas, new elements. And I'm very open to that. Mm-hmm. I don't believe as a composer I should be so restrictive of the musicians. That's why I work with the people I work with. I want to have their input. They have a story to tell also. So
now, if you were to compose, say I said to you, Brian, can you compose a classical work?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to me?
No problem, Jill. When do you want it? What's the contract?
How much? Which,
no. It's not a. I'm a composer, and
but how would you go about that?
Well, it's the same as what are we talking about? In other words, what is the theme? What are we trying to portray? I'm a programmatic writer. I generally have a concept in mind,
a picture,
an element of an emotion. So before you could say, give me a classical piece, I'd say, what are we looking for? Here's how I got interested in Ali. I'll do this real quick. Bill Evans once, I always was amazed at Bill's comping with his left hand. And Bill said that he used to watch boxing. He was a big sports fan.
What did you say? Comping?
Yeah,
that is the
accompanying of your right hand melodic line with your left hand, playing the chord alongside of it. We refer to that as
that's
comping.
That's called comping. Okay.
Yeah. And how he did that, and it had such a fluid motion. He said, well, watch Ali's jab. Yeah, he got me watching Ali. And then, of course, I became just fascinated by the man. When I made this composition, when I composed this, I was trying to tell a multiple story. I got to say that no point in art is one level. I always try to find more than one. Many years ago, I was studying photography with a great teacher named Lou Draper outside of Mercer County. And he once put up a photograph and said his teacher, the great photographer Minor White, once said, okay, let's look at this photograph. It's a flower, but what else is it? Now, every composition I look at, everything I try to do, and everything I judge art by is always, what else is it? What's beyond the surface?
See, what I was trying to get at when I asked you if I asked you to compose a classical piece of music, this is a very difficult thing to isolate. But what I'm really saying to you is getting away from, like an arranger will take music and mm-hmm. arrange it in the style of
yes.
Dvorak
mm-hmm.
or Tchaikovsky mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. Bill Evans or
right.
whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you draw the line between writing in a particular genre and arranging it to sound like something? Where does the classic versus the jazz come in something like that?
Interesting. We have to talk about what the differences are between jazz as a form of music and entity. And classical, some of the very nuts and bolts stuff, so that we can get down to it. One of the elements we're gonna use a term that is very difficult to understand. It's a term of swing. The eighth note to a classical musician is, if the time is 1/2, bop 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 bop. To a jazz musician, that same thing would be bop 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 bop. You see, it's more of a triplet feel to it. That's just one area. There are certain scales and modes that are used frequently in jazz. The blue note, we've all heard that famous blue note, the flat third, the flat five. That interval, that sound is very much more of a jazz element. Jazz generally is using a form, the popular music form, the 24 measure ABA form, which is something that classical musicians don't, if we're looking to write a piece of classical music, we would not look in that form. We would look for a longer form, more extended composition. Some other areas. I mean, and just the things we were talking about, there has to be room for improvisation. So the actual structure, the chords, the way I'd approach the chords would be differently. Yes, the sounds might be the same, but I would write it differently for a jazz musician. They're used to improvising in flat keys. Very rarely will a jazz musician, improvise in B, you know, the key of B because of the sharps. They'll generally, it'll be B flat. Those are some of the things as a composer you're going to look at and you're going to think about.
I think that happens generally even with instruments. Certain instruments can play in certain keys easier than
others. They sound better.
Yeah.
But also, there was a time when music, it seems as it was almost one. Very much in the dance element. Gottschalk with his cakewalks, and the next thing you know, we had simultaneously going on the influence of the black community coming in through Scott Joplin, was starting to take them cakewalks expand them a little, slow them down in some ways, slur them a little.
They were more relaxed.
Yes,
not
they
as
were.
Strict.
And then the next man, the inventor of jazz, everybody's, the originator of jazz, Mr. Jelly Roll Morton, came in where he added, once again, the elements of swing that da 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 became very, very predominant. And he also brought in breaks, where he'd have a break where a musician would solo freely for four beats or approximately, two measures. He would shine, just start, break away from the band and play something that would be improvised.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have written a piece as mm-hmm. part of a group of pieces called Portraits. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Your approach to writing these, I guess, was a classically thought-out approach. You were writing programmatically
music. Absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, I generally do.
And, and for me, this has a very classical element in it. It's created in a very classical structure, even though you may be using some jazz elements.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about what we're going to listen to next.
The next piece we're going to do is Bardot. Let me say it at first. I truly admire Brigitte Bardot. When I first saw the film In God Created Woman, I found in her a sensuality that you don't find in many of the film stars, as it were, of today. So there is a reoccurring theme. There is a theme that comes back, a leitmotif that I use over and over again through the composition. You'll see and hear, I hope you'll hear, the deterioration, the changes, and the effects of fame upon her, the effects of her life, of being closed off.
Brian, you have a surprise for us now.
Well, yeah. We were talking about composition quite a bit. One of my favorite composers is Stephen Sondheim. And a particular show and a favorite show of mine is Sweeney Todd. On the first album I released here in the States, Wind, Water, Stone, we did one of his tunes. We interpreted one of his tunes with Kelly Rodriguez on vocal, myself on piano. So we'd like to play Stephen Sondheim's Not While I'm Around from Sweeney Todd. That's Stephen Sondheim's Not While I'm Around from Sweeney Todd. One of the things I tried to find in that performance was a sense of fear, a sense of a duality. We've talked before a little earlier, I think it was about the what else is it? And I needed that sense of fear in this performance. I think Kelly got it very well, by the way. Sondheim has affected me greatly as a composer. I think he's one of my favorite composers. I think he is the musical theater here in America right now.
Would you put him in that category alone?
Yes. Absolutely. And Todd is one of the great works. We actually used to do in performance about a 20-minute segment of Sweeney Todd. And in the middle of it, we would do the main theme and two or three other in trio performance, and Kelly would sing that in the dead center of it to add a little element of that vocal and that little other elements. But unfortunately, a 20-minute segment in a concert is a lot, But go ahead.
Yeah, what I was going to say is, when you think about musical comedy, and even the it's musical theater now. It's not comedy anymore. I mean, when you think of the plot of Sweeney Todd.
Yeah, yeah. But that's part of it, too. I found that it's kind of amusing. They really make light of a pretty horrendous situation.
Really?
He is a great poet, though. He's a writer. His ability with words, he finds the right word at the right time.
You know, Brian, you said much earlier about it's the little things that make life...
When you
wrote that tune, Bernstein's
Bernstein's Girl, right?
Yeah. Well, Sondheim takes the little things of life, and he puts them in a very special light, and he writes these songs about feelings, about mundane things that happen to all of us. And of course, he is a master of the craft.
We spoke earlier, just before going to lunch, when we were talking earlier today about, at that time, those lyricists, the Lorenz Harts. You know, these people went to work every day and wrote lyrics, worked on the right word and the right phrase, much like any great poet would do. And, Jill, you had mentioned that performance you saw recently or heard, that someone actually spoke the words to a foggy day.
Right. It's amazing when you take it out of the context that you know it in, and then you can see it for what it is. It's a gem when you take it out of the setting. It has a whole different brilliance. And I think it also reflects what has happened in our society today, at the risk of getting very philosophical. The darkness of musical theater now, the seriousness of it. Yes, they handled the subject matter of Sweeney Todd in a... It's a black comedy, really.
Yeah, it really is.
Sondheim
really
certainly has been a prime mover in this kind of theater.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Brian, all I can say is that we've seen the many facets of your talent. It's been just a real joy to have you here with us today. There's so much more to talk about. Promise us you'll come back?
Oh, absolutely. I love it.
Well, Brian Traynor, here on Crossover.